The title of your documentary comes from environmentalist and historian Wallace Stegner, who called the national park system America's best idea. In what way do they fulfill that?
Well, I think in some ways they are the Declaration of Independence, democracy applied to the landscape. For the first time in human history, land was set aside not for kings or noblemen or the very rich, as land through all of human history had been set aside, but for everybody and for all time. And while you could debate whether it's America's best idea, and people do in the film, whether it's Mr. Jefferson who does it, it's certainly true that once you've created a United States, you'd be hard-pressed to find anything that's a better idea. It's interesting because it's sort of paradoxical. It arrests the tendency, the acquisitive and extractive tendency of most human beings, and particularly Americans, that look at a river and see a dam, look at a stand of trees and see bored feet, look at a canyon and want to mine it. But we had the foresight, a few of us, a handful of us did, who dedicated their lives to saving these special places. It's now been copied around the world. So in some ways, like the idea of freedom itself, it's our greatest export. And they are wonderful refuges, oases from the momentum of our life, in which many of us who visit participate in a continuity, an essential continuity between generations as we pass down the love of the parks, but also open ourselves, make ourselves available to experiences that are, some would describe them as religious or spiritual, other than just such powerful moments that they are transcendent and memorable in our lives. And boy, just that alone would be worth it, let alone saving all the wildlife. There'd be no bison left if there wasn't a Yellowstone National Park. So many other species, plant and animal diversity. And then we've now expanded the idea, like all men are created equal, is expanded to include historical sites, even places of shame. There are locations like Manzanar where we intern Japanese American citizens. It's as complex, as evolving as the ideas initiated in the Declaration of Independence, and in many ways just as revolutionary.
In some ways, then, the film does follow in with the patterns of your already previously established trilogy of American films like The Civil War and Baseball and Jazz, in that this is something that America has done and the rest of the world is sharing in it and benefiting from it in that regard.
Without a doubt. I have spent more than 35 years of my professional life trying to figure out who we are. I mean, in some ways, the secret is I've made the same film over and over again. And each one of those films asks this question, who are we? Who are those strange and complicated people who like to call themselves Americans? And it's very clear that we have played an unusual role in the positive progress of mankind. Not to say that we haven't had problems, we have, that we don't still have problems, we do. But I'm interested in trying to figure out a little bit about what the American experience is as it speaks to the aspirations of human beings. And I think all of the films that you've mentioned and all the others that we've worked on have in some ways touched or connected or butted up against these very central ideas of who we are. You can't really pin them down ever. You're only deepening the question, who are we, with each project. But I think that's what it's about, is this pursuit of happiness, not the happiness at the end, but the pursuit.
Let's go back just a little bit, and please elaborate for me about how the National Park System even got started. The film covers some 150 years of history.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Most human beings, most Americans think that the parks have always been there. They haven't. That there's been a park service to take care of them. There wasn't. And that they'll always be there. And that's not true unless we're all vigilant, like Liberty, in ensuring that they're taken care of. I mean, this is essentially a story of ownership. All of us are part owners, co-owners of some of the most magnificent beachfront mountains, waterfalls, geothermal features, and the grandest canyon on Earth. And all we have to do is visit our property once in a while, make sure it's being taken care of, and put it in our will for our kids. That's a great bargain. But in 1864, in the middle of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln signed into law a bill creating a park in what we now know as Yosemite. It was then given to the state of California for its management, but it was the first time that it ever happened. And 8 years later, President Grant, signed into law a bill creating Yellowstone National Park. Well, the entity was Wyoming Territory, and there was no entity, so it just accidentally became a national park. No money was appropriated. there was no rules about how to behave towards the wildlife. Poachers were a problem. Vandals were a problem in both the places. In the early days, the cavalry took care of them. In Yosemite and Sequoia National Park, it was the African-American buffalo soldiers, the cavalry members, celebrated Indian fighters who ironically took care of it in a decade dedicated to more African Americans being lynched than in any other decade. I mean, strange early stories. But by 1916, the Park Service was established, and then it began to coalesce into this system that has grown and evolved over that time. And as we approach in the not-too-distant future, 2016, its centennial, there's opportunities to look back and celebrate what they've achieved, which is managing yet another paradox, which is we're supposed to leave it now for the enjoyment and benefit of the people, but also leave it unimpaired for future generations. And all those tensions of attendance, if you've ever been in a traffic jam in Yellowstone, you know what I mean. But these are the problems that democracies, thank God, have to struggle with.
I think over the years there must have been some clash also between public and private when it comes to the national park system, and we're probably still seeing that, I imagine, today with the way the parks are managed. Would that be the case?
Absolutely. This is the central drama of the national parks, particularly in their creation stories. It's always going against the grain of those people who want to dam something or mine it or chop it down or whatever, develop it, hold it in private use. One could imagine the Grand Canyon lined with mansions that would make it impossible for any of us mere mortals to even approach one of the just supreme and sublime works of nature on this planet. The Park Service, in every instance, had to kind of arrest that momentum or at least be challenged by it. And what's so interesting is that when you talk to people about the Park Service, they normally see, say, Teddy Roosevelt. Well, he was important. He appears partially in our second episode, but that's it. It's really a lot of ordinary, so-called ordinary people, about 50 or so we'll introduce to you in the course of the production, just, you know, male and female, black and white and red and yellow and brown, and all from every walk of life, rich and poor. And it's their story of falling in love with a place and insisting on the politicians above them to take notice and to save this place. That's how they've been created. And each one of those parks has a story of someone like that that's been a champion. You know, I just met a man who had just worked really hard for a state park in Texas next to Big Bend, and he spent 17 years of his life trying to make it so. And we have others who've spent 32 years of their life or their entire life and fortunes trying to set aside these places. So what we have is this magnificent, naturally, organically diverse story filled with all sorts of interesting people.
Well, and you mentioned Texas, and today I'm speaking to you here at Mission San Jose, part of the National Park System in the San Antonio Missions, and Big Bend National Park, of course, is one of our greatest parks here in the state of Texas, and you know we're darn proud of it, of course, as Texans, and that is featured in the film, I believe, as one of the gentlemen who helped establish the film is one of your subjects.
That's exactly right. You know, we're in tough economic times, and the first stimulus money was FDR's New Deal money to help us in the Depression, and the first shovel-ready dollars went to the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, which helped employ a lot of young men to help pull them out of poverty and build some of the trails and rest areas that we enjoy today. And we've interviewed a man named Juan Lujan from Redford, not too far from Big Bend on the Rio Grande, who as a young man was desperately poor and ended up in the CCC camp, and he describes that. We are also have made a lot of ancillary materials. When we realized just how authentic this diversity was with the park, that there wasn't anything politically correct about talking about the first biologist of the Park Service, a man named George Melendez Wright, or talking about Lancelot Jones, the son of a slave in Florida helping to save Biscayne Bay. We then began to expand that and produce ancillary materials and little films that are contemporary. Our film, of course, only goes up to 1980. That's what we feel comfortable as historians. But we've made a lot of other contemporary films, including The Woman Who Was So Instrumental in Saving the Alamo and the the missions, and that's a huge part available to all the schools, to the Park Service, that will be broadcast by local public television stations. That is part of the DVD extras on our DVD set that will be released the day the film series starts in September, not waiting any longer, and it's in the book, our companion book from Alfred Knopf. So we think Texans, who are proud of just about everything that they do, I will be very proud of how they're represented, as is Big Ben in this story.
Are some of these ancillary materials part of the what I've read about the Untold Stories project that's coming with the film?
That's exactly right. We received some production funding from the Evelyn and Walter Haas Jr. Fund from San Francisco, which was very helpful to the production. But they were so intrigued by our traditional educational outreach and by all of the diversity in the film that they challenged us to sort of enlarge this, to focus on these untold stories, to create separate entities, visual entities that can be used in schools to accompany the larger series. And it's been thrilling to be challenged that way. Normally we'd go out and at some age group, depending on what we had determined was the appropriate age group, every classroom in America, every teacher would have study guides and materials and other site to be able to log on to get even more material, and that will be the case. But what we've recognized is that there are still some communities, underserved communities, often minority communities, that do not yet feel an ownership of the national parks the way so many of us do. And we want to go into and have been going into those cities, those communities, those neighborhoods, and reminding them that they are there, that they're theirs as well, but that there are people in the history of these parks that look and sound like them, and that they are legitimate American heroes that they're not being taught about. And we want to let you know about these people so that you can begin to acquire that sense of pride that those of us who love the parks, that depend on them for our sanity and our well-being and this kind of immersion into something bigger than ourselves. You know, the big paradox is you want it for the enjoyment now, but leave it unimpaired. So how do you figure that out? And that's a constant tension. The internal paradox is, John Muir said, in order to go in, I have to go out. In order to know about myself, I need to go out in nature. That all of us have this experience of feeling our insignificance in the place of these great natural parks. And yet that enlarges us, just like an egomaniac is diminished by that egomania when we meet them in our daily lives. And that's an interesting thing that the parks do. And every person that we talk to had some transforming experience that changed their lives. It's happened to me. It happened to Dayton Duncan, the co-producer and co-writer of the series. It happened to every single one of the characters that we illuminate in the film and all of the experts that we interviewed to help tell that story, as well as all the folks we've been sharing it with along this promotional tour, that they suddenly volunteer that moment when the sun was going down or the moon was rising or the sun was just rising, and they suddenly felt bigger than themselves. They suddenly felt alive in a way they hadn't felt before. And it was only being out there and feeling small in nature that they could have that paradoxically enlarging experience. And that's thrilling to contemplate. And what we'd love is to have every superintendent mad at us after this broadcast because they got crowds they didn't know what to do with. That's the kind of problem you want to have in a democracy.
It's interesting that you mentioned the spiritual aspect of the parks, because many of them, of course, are on lands that Native Americans held sacred before. And I think that still holds true for a lot of us when we go there. We feel that same experience that they must have felt being in that place.
One of the things we try so hard to dispel in this is the notion of discovery of these places. What we chart is the discovery by European ancestors of a particular place, entering, shall we say, recorded history. But what we're mindful of and make a conscious effort at every time we arrive at a place is to speak about those native peoples who had occupied that land for hundreds, if not thousands, of generations. And I think that helps enlarge the story. There's a grand geological story, of course, that is sometimes billions of years old in the case of the Grand Canyon. There's a long, long ethnographic and anthropological study as we understand the layers of human experience at these places. And then, of course, there's this intimate personal family thing. My grandfather took my father to national parks. He took me. I've taken my daughters. And so I'm perpetuating a kind of immortality, as John Muir would say, a practical immortality that comes from our relationship with nature, our exposure to these moments, or putting us in the way of the possibility that one moment might be so vivified that we'll remember it for the rest of our lives.
Although many folks really recognized artistically what you were doing with your previous film, The War, by limiting the subjects and the locales where you were drawing from in order to create a bigger picture for the overall World War II, there was some criticism that came from the Latino and Hispanic communities that felt that they weren't represented in the film. But did that experience change the way you approach your themes and subjects at all?
Oh, not at all. And in fact, I've spent all my life telling stories that haven't been told in American history. The history of the West we did just didn't tell the usual gunslinger stories, but in fact told a Hispanic narrative in every single film, in my Statue of Liberty film, in the baseball film, in the jazz film. We've done it. And we'd already worked out the stories of the Hispanic stories that are in this well before that so-called controversy came up. I mean, we just threw darts at a map. We interviewed hundreds of people asking them if they'd talk about their battle experience. Many Hispanics came forward and didn't want to talk. They said the real heroes were their friends that they left on the battlefield from these four towns. There had been 1,000 films on World War II, and we were really trying to look at it differently, as the poet William Blake said, to find the universe in a grain of sand. There were no German Americans in our film, a much larger immigrant group than Hispanics at the time. There were no Irish Americans in our film. There were no, hundreds of other. We weren't looking for a particular ethnicity. We did have a couple of African Americans who came forward willing to talk, a couple of Japanese Americans from Sacramento, one of our cities, who spoke about internment and that. But we weren't after that. In fact, all the mail I got was from Hispanic veterans who were furious at the controversy because they said, when I put on the uniform of the United States, I wasn't a Mexican-American, I was an American. And that was the point of moving here. That was the point of fighting and possibly dying for my country. But, I want to tell everybody's story. And while when I heard about it, I instantly went out and filmed two veterans, Hispanic veterans, who weren't from our community. So it threw off what we were planning to do, but had the much better effect of adding two more terrifying, poignant, deadly stories of two men engaged in the South Pacific in this particular group of raiders that was terrifying. And so we immediately solved the problem. It was sort of a win-win situation. And so the one thing I would ask, though, in a time where we become sometimes distracted by identity politics, that A, you know what this particular film's ambitions were, and that B, you look at it before you criticize it, and none of those things happened. And we felt that we were obligated, as we are in all the films we made, to tell a very broad and diverse story, and we have not ever abandoned a Hispanic narrative. It just turned out that those soldiers that were still alive in the communities we randomly chose did not want to speak. The series already had dozens of photographs of Hispanics in it, because it is my intention always to do that, but no one on camera. And remember, of those 650 people that we talked to, only 43 agreed to be filmed. And of those, only 6 or 7 agreed to talk about combat. So already we'd seen the whole World War II and the horror of war we were trying to do through the eyes of just a handful of people.
What will folks be seeing tonight at the preview?
Well, what we want to do is share the sense of what we've been talking about here, is the diversity of the people. It isn't just the Teddy Roosevelts and the John Muir and the John D. Rockefellers, the noblesse oblige of the rich, though they did it genuinely and with great passion and love for the parks. But it's also a bottom-up story. So we're sharing the story of George Melendez Wright, the first biologist of the National Park Service, who really helped rearrange the molecules of how we saw animals and habitat and things like that. Up to that point, they were zoological gardens where, bears were fed at garbage dumps and encouraged to be fed by the side of the road, and predators were shot. And he was saying, no, these are complex ecosystems that we have to leave alone. It's their primitive state that matters most. And it's okay and fun to see a bear like that eating garbage, but it's much better to be along a trail and see that bear trying to get the grubs out of a rotten log. That gives you a glimpse into our own primeval relationship. He's a marvelous character. A couple of Japanese Americans who fell in love with the parks and whose stories are kind of central to the spirit of what we're doing, and some other great things, including the story about the New Deal and the early stimulus. I figured, given this time, you'd love to see something incredibly positive that came out of really, really much darker times than we even experience now, and some other stuff that will be a surprise. But it's about an hour's worth of stuff, and of course filmmakers hate to show just little bits of their film.
Now, your longtime sponsor, General Motors, recently announced that they can no longer fund your film projects. It seems like the era of big corporate sponsors for projects like this is nearing its end, though they're committed for some films that are still in the pipeline. And I understand that they made up to 35% of the budget for some of your films and your projects. How will you make up the difference?
Well, actually, in a couple cases, it was 35%. The average is more like 25%. They've been underwriting my film since 1987, and we knew in 1999 when we made this 10-year deal that it would end this year. So it's not really a consequence at all of this current financial crisis, and we've already replaced them with other underwriters. The more difficult situation is that after you have that 25%, you got to get the 75% from somewhere else, and it can't be a corporation. So it's private foundations and government granting agencies. And those private foundations have seen their endowments drop significantly and are now loath to participate. So the anxiety is less corporate America being its usual good citizen, participating in the arts, the local symphony, the jazz festival, whatever it is that the corporations have been funding, public television. But it's also been those foundations that have been the backbone of American philanthropy that now found their ability to fund things cut sometimes in half and sometimes even more. And it just makes it a little bit more difficult for those of us who are dependent on that kind of support. But, you know, just roll up your sleeves and go at it again. But General Motors did not pull out because of this current crisis. It was a 10-year deal coming to an end.
Well, Ken Burns, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate that, and good luck with this film and your many projects in the future. We look forward to to continued success and wonderful documents of American history.
Thank you so much. You know, I think the most rewarding aspect of all of this is that the first time I went to a film class, the first day was this debate about whether films actually made people do something. And people have been galvanized by these documentaries, and they've gone to visit these sites, and they've walked over the Brooklyn Bridge, the subject of an early film. They've increased the attendance at battlefields at Gettysburg and Antietam 200% and 300%. And I think that's a testament to the power of this medium of film and television and the ability to reach people. So I'm thrilled to be here in San Antonio to help share this message, and hope people get to watch the whole series in September and to go visit the national parks.